Today I'm going to continue with the fourth part of my four-part sermon, Mystery Babylon. Now, as we saw before with Mystery Babylon religion, we saw that Satan, he established a counterfeit religious system in Babylon shortly after the flood, and he used the biblical character Nimrod as his tool for creating a system of government and religious order to control the population and to keep them from worshiping the true God. My goal today is to show how this mystery religion spread through the four kingdoms of Daniel's prophecy, contaminating modern Christianity and also its future role before Christ's return. Now, this Nimrod, whoever he was, Gilgamesh, Sargon, Merkar, or Marduk, he set himself up as a protector of the people, then gained control over them and became a tyrant who desired to be worshipped himself as a god. He would be considered the first world ruler, and there have been many since him who have tried to achieve the same status. Nebuchadnezzar is an interesting biblical character to examine in this light. He was a mighty ruler, conquering many nations, including Judah. In Daniel chapter 2, we see that he is struggling with this dream of an image. Daniel tells this ruler the meaning which God revealed to him. Nebuchadnezzar comes off of his high pedestal and he acknowledges God. In Daniel chapter 2 and verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." About 16 years pass from these events in chapter 2 and also in chapter 3. And Nebuchadnezzar, who once acknowledged that God, that the God of Daniel was the God of God and the Lord of kings, has forgotten. And now it's a distant memory. He himself was honored and worshipped as a god by the Babylonians. In Daniel chapter 3 and verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. And he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. The dimensions of the 6 cubits wide and 60 cubits high introduces the number 6, which is very prominent in the Bible as the number of man, as Revelation chapter 13, verse 18 says. And also, we know that man was created on the sixth day. 60 cubits is equivalent to 90 feet. And this statue was very slender, probably only about 9 feet wide. And most likely this figure was not a figure of a man, but it was more like an obelisk that you see in Egypt. Many Bible commentators like Joseph Benson believe that it was a statue in honor of the god of Babylon, Bel Marduk. Nebuchadnezzar may have regarded the image as representing himself as the embodiment of the divine power. And the worship of the image would have been a recognition of his personal power as well. Now, chapter 4 of Daniel, it kind of shows us. Of course, we know how God sent his angel to protect Daniel's three friends in the furnace. And looking at the wording in verse 28, his angel tends to lean towards a pre-incarnate Jesus as the one who was with them. Still, as verses 28 and 29 show, Nebuchadnezzar does not recognize the God of the Jews as the only God, just one of many. Chapter 4 of Daniel has the king once again with his dream that Daniel explains to him and gives him a warning. He gave him a warning. A year later, Nebuchadnezzar still thinks he is greater than God. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you until you know the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses." Verse 34. "At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar," these are his own words now, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever." It took him a while, but he actually acknowledged God. But I wonder if he truly learned his lesson and if he truly gave up his gods. Many have wanted the power as the ruler of the world, as history shows, and they did so through religious systems demanding that the people worship a false gods. The pharaohs of Egypt thought of themselves as gods. Alexander the Great felt that way as he conquered the world. He believed he was Apollo, the son of Zeus. The Roman Caesars claimed to be gods and demanded worship from their citizens as well. For 2,000 years, the Japanese believed that their most reverend god, the sun goddess Amaterasu, I said that wrong, Amaterasu, oh boy, I always have fun with this. I actually got it written down here, but it's Amaterasu. Sent her grandson to Earth, according to Japan, to rule over the people as emperor. In World War II, the Japanese still believed their emperor was a god. It took General MacArthur very little time to destroy this image of their emperor as he surrendered to them. In many of these scenarios, the ruler establishes a system of government intertwined with a religion. Satan is behind the scenes here, orchestrating the leaders with this philosophy, and in this way, these rulers can control the masses and convince the populace that they are not only representing God, but they are themselves a god. This system has always worked very well for them too. Another World War II example of this is Mussolini. He intertwined fascism and religion, the Roman Catholic religion. Mussolini said fascism is a religious conception. He was actually a socialist and an atheist, but as he gained power, he knew he needed the church in Rome to back him. An article from the New North website entitled "Mussolini the Messiah" by Benjamin Joseph Dosher says, "All tyrants use human nature to take power, and historically religion provides that power. History has shown that religious indoctrination controls." He goes on to say that El Duce knew of what his propagandist preaching espoused. It is an obvious truism. Religion and fascism share many of the same components. In fact, fascism is just political religion and worship of an earthly god. Mussolini used this knowledge to harness the power in Italy, as his uber-fascist nickname indicates. Hans Lehmers and Bettina Retz-Juice recount in the Codex Fori Mussolini, the theme is connected with the recurring image of the Duce as the bringer of light. Such light metaphors serve to suggest the substitution of a Christian Messiah by his earthly fascist counterpart, the Duce. Assumes the role of Christ and as the modern light of the world. Mussolini convinced Pope Pius XI that he was this light. After taking power, El Duce outlawed Freemasonry. He exempted the clergy from taxation. He cracked down on artificial contraception, campaigned for an increased birth rate, raised penalties for abortion, restricted nightlife, and regulated women's clothing, and banned homosexual acts among adult men. And despite having many mistresses himself, he also put in place a harsh punishment for adultery. In 1929, Mussolini signed an agreement with the Vatican under which the church received authority over marriage and was compensated for property that had been seized decades earlier. Pope Pius XI, afterwards, he referred to Mussolini as the man whom Providence has sent us. Mussolini thought of himself as God's gift to Italy and began to resurrect the Holy Roman Empire, the sixth out of the seven prophesied in Revelation chapter 17. This, of course, speaks of the seven kings or kingdoms of the great harlot, Mystery Babylon, that Mystery Babylon the Great will influence. He, along with Hitler, attempted to get the blessings from the Pope as part of that revival. Both leaders did receive authorization from Pope Pius XI. However, Mussolini, after Mussolini, he adopted some of the same racial laws that were similar to those in Nazi Germany. The Pope did not see the light anymore in either of the rulers. On a grand scale, this was the last time that rulers of nations attempted to control the world. There will be one more major attempt, according to Scripture, which we will look at later. But this leader requires a blessing, as one might say, of a religious leader. In the former attempts to revive the Roman Empire, the ruler received recognition from a church leader, and in these cases, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church gave the blessing. The Pope has many titles, including Vicar of Christ, Vicar of Jesus Christ, which means in place of Jesus. This relates to the image of the woman, a church, riding the beast, a nation, or kingdom. Before we continue to see how this occurred in history, we have to look at Daniel's insight to Nebuchadnezzar's dream that God had revealed to him. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel explains to Nebuchadnezzar that he represents the head of gold of this statue as the first great kingdom, and that three more kingdoms would follow his. Then Daniel tells him that the God of heaven will set up another final kingdom that will never end, the kingdom of God. Who are these other kingdoms? In Daniel chapter 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. So this is after King Nebuchadnezzar II, who ruled for 43 years. Now after King Nebuchadnezzar II, Emel-Marduk, which means man of Marduk, which was his son, he ruled after his death. He was also known as Evil Merodach in Jeremiah chapter 52 and verse 31, and also in 2 Kings chapter 25 and verse 27, Evil Merodach, or Emel Marduk. And in both of those scriptures, it mentions Nebuchadnezzar's son, who actually released Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, from prison. That's how he's referred to as doing that act. He only lasted 2 years, since his brother-in-law, General Nergisler, seized control of the throne by force. That's right. Now, he was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar II, having married his daughter. And he didn't like how Amel Marduk was running things. So Nergisler was in charge for about 4 years when his son, Labashi Marduk, which means may I not come to shame, O Marduk, Labashi Marduk, when he was only a child, became king. He was only a child. And because he was only a child, he was unfit to rule. And he was murdered in a conspiracy only 9 months after his inauguration. Nabonidus, which means revere of Nabu, one of the Babylonian gods, Nabu, which also is part of Nebuchadnezzar's name. Nabonidus was a Babylonian prince and was also believed to have been related to Nebuchadnezzar through marriage, as well as he took over as king. And he was believed that he married another one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters. He is known as a religious reformer since he promoted the Mesopotamian triad of gods. They had their own trinity. Their gods were Sin, the exact same spelling, Sin, Shamash, and Ishtar, which basically represented the moon, sun, and Venus. As venerated in Haran, in the town of Haran, that's the same town that Abraham and his family dwelt. But it conflicted with the Babylonian religious establishment. See, the Canaanite mythology, this Shemesh, or as she's actually called in extra-biblical texts, Shepesh, was the daughter of El and Asherah, a sun goddess, and was also considered to be one of the main deities of the Canaanite pantheon. Her cultic center of worship was in Belt Shemesh, and Shemesh was worshipped, as you can see, in Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 16, if you want to check that out later. Now, Sin, S-I-N, sometimes it's Suin, or also Nana, was a Sumerian god of the moon. The two chief seats of Sin's worship were in Ur in the south, and later in Haran to the north. Now, as mentioned before, this Nabonidus was most likely married to another one of the daughters of King Nebuchadnezzar. And he became king of Babylon in 555 BC. He neglected the festivities that gave honor to the god Marduk, Bel Marduk, their main god. And instead, he had built a temple for the cult of the moon god Sin. And his mother and daughter were its priestesses. This worship of the moon god in favor of the traditional Babylonian deity made Nabonidus' rule disputed. 5 years after his succession, his son, Belshazzar, was named co-regent and thus became the actual ruler of Babylon. Now, this is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, the one who saw the handwriting on the wall before Babylon fell. His father, Nabonidus, was off in Haran with his own little worship there. Well, he tried to come back to Babylon, and as he was coming back, he was captured by Cyrus's general, Gobryas, and then he was exiled. So this Belshazzar is, many of the Bible scholars try to say that he wasn't related to Nebuchadnezzar, but he was his grandson. The language makes it sound like it was his son, but that's just how you refer to people in those times. But Belshazzar was real. He was a co-regent. And in Daniel 7, Daniel describes these four nations as beast. The same four nations represented in the statue of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Again, who are these nations? Well, it's very clear to all in the scriptures of who these nations represent. The churches of God have all explained from scriptures which nations or kingdoms are represented here, as well as many other churches and biblical scholars. It is not a mystery. It's not unknown to others. On the Walvoord.com website, Dr. John F. Walvoord, he was the president of the Dallas Theological Seminary, he wrote an article, Revival of Rome. Revival of Rome. In it, he says that many others like C.F. Keel have identified the four kingdoms based on Scripture alone. All seem to agree. So let's look at the four kingdoms. We know the first was Babylon. That's obvious. And that the other nations or kingdoms would conquer in order from first to last. We know from Daniel 5 that the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon. So they were the second. Who is the third nation? Daniel chapter 8 and chapter 10 again mention the Medo-Persian Empire as the second kingdom, but it also that the Macedo-Grecian Empire, or Greece, is the third nation which conquered the Persians. Now, who is the fourth? Well, let's look at the description of the fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, and it was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom the three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this horn, were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. This beast was indeed different. Continuing on with verses 9 and 10, it describes God's throne, which you can look at later. But in verse 11, it says, I watched then, because the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Verses 13 and 14, now it actually envisions the return of Jesus Christ. In verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I'd be troubled too if I had visions like he had. But now it was actually was explained to him. See, history shows that the Roman Empire conquered Greece, and therefore is the fourth beast or the fourth kingdom to rule. History has shown us that the Roman Empire was divided into two kingdoms. One in the west at Rome, and one in the east at Constantinople, which is accurately described with the picture of the two legs of the image in Daniel chapter 2. See, after decades of decline, the Roman Empire in the west at Rome indeed received the deadly wound. In AD 476, when the Roman Empire, Romulus Augustulus, was disposed of by their Germanic tribes. United Church of God's commentary on this says, the 10 horns of the fourth beast are symbolic of the 10 kings or kingdoms. Notice the expression, three of the first horns, in verse 8. It could be rendered that the first three horns. It seems to indicate that there would be 10 revivals of the Roman Empire, the first three of which are uprooted and subdued by the additional little horn, and the last of which would itself comprise of 10 distinct powers or nations. The Western Empire in Rome collapsed in the 5th century as three groups of barbarians and invaders sought to succeed the Roman emperors. These were the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. With each, they did seek and did receive official recognition from the Eastern Roman Emperor as the legitimate continuation of Roman rule in the West. But there's a problem. Even though the Eastern Emperor recognized that, they didn't have the blessing of the church in the East or in the West. With the perspective of the Western religious leader, the bishop of Rome or the Pope, these barbarians, they were not Orthodox Catholic Trinitarians because they had adopted a form of Christianity known as Arianism. And at the Pope's urging, each of these barbarian tribes were eventually overthrown by the Eastern Roman Emperor. They did not receive the blessing. These are the three horns that were plucked up by the little horn. Following this, the Eastern Roman Emperor, Justinian, reclaimed a lot of the Western imperial territory and placed it under the management of the Roman Catholic provincial bishops. This is often referred to as the imperial restoration in history. This is the first of seven, according to Revelation chapter 17, and the fourth of 10, according to Daniel chapter 7. This revival was followed by the Carolinian emperor of Charlemagne, who was crowned by Pope Leo III in 800 AD. The third revival was the Holy Roman Empire of Otto the Great, who was crowned by Pope John the 12th in 962 AD. After this, the Habsburg dynasty ruled the ancient Roman Empire plus more, but only Charles V was crowned by the Pope in 1530 AD, therefore becoming the fourth revival of the Holy Roman Empire. It was followed by Napoleon's empire of 1804 to 1814 AD. In 1804, Napoleon crowned himself Emperor of France. And later that year, he was crowned Emperor Napoleon I by Pope Pius II at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, making him the fifth ruler of this revived Roman Empire. The next was Mussolini and Hitler's attempt, which we already spoke about. Theirs was the ninth of 10, according to Daniel chapter 7, and the sixth of the last seven horns in Revelation chapter 17, which were recognized by the little horn, the religious leader at the time. In this case, it was the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, this is a key factor that some were recognized by the religious leader, but the three barbarian-led empires were not recognized. So they were plucked up by this little horn. This little horn with eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous word in Daniel chapter 7 is the same as the two-horned lamb-like beast of Revelation chapter 13. The beast from the earth, as it's referred to. In Revelation chapter 13, Revelation chapter 13, beginning in verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that even makes fire to come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. The second beast with an earthly, not a heavenly, but an earthly origin is the same as this little horn. It outwardly masquerades as being Christian, seeking to be identified with Christ, with the Lamb of God, but receives its power from Satan, that old dragon. Revelation chapter 9 and verse 12. Or Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9. In biblical prophecy, horns are used to represent rulership or authority. And this creature is pictured with two horns. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 12 reveals that this second beast insists that all give their allegiance and loyalty to the Holy Roman Empire, the first beast, which is mentioned in this chapter. The second beast is described as performing great miracles, which will deceive humanity. In Matthew chapter 24, verse 24, Jesus prophesied of false Christ, who will deceive all, possibly even the very elect. This little horn and the second beast share the same identity as this harlot sitting on the beast in Revelation chapter 17. Mystery Babylon the Great. So how did this Roman church come to be identified with Babylon? From the article that I mentioned before by Dr. Waldward, he says, in the vision given to the Apostle John as recorded in Revelation chapter 17, he is invited to see this amazing wicked woman who is described as sitting upon the scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Revelation 17 verse 3. She is further portrayed as decked in purple and scarlet with gold and precious stones. The total picture is well adapted to describe religion typified by the woman in alliance with the political, which is seen as the scarlet-colored beast, identified as a future political power of the end time in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 1. The woman is described, and he continues here, the woman is described, according to Revelation chapter 17 and verse 5, as having a name, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. This, of course, gathers much material referring to Rome politically, in that Rome, as an empire, had borrowed much of its religious system from ancient Babylon. But it also introduces the question as whether the woman is specifically Roman, which is a very good question, which we will look at later. But he identifies that Rome borrowed a lot of the Babylonian religion. When we understand Daniel's vision of the Babylonian Empire being replaced by the Persians, the Greeks, and then finally the Roman Empire, we can see how this transfer of government ideas along with the religious system actually spread. We have seen how the Babylonian god, Bel-Marduk, was worshipped in Babylon as a sun god. And we've already examined how other nations and cultures adopted this sun god and worship with various names in the previous sermons that I gave on this subject. In ancient Babylon, the king served as high priest of the sun god, Bel-Marduk. To take the hand of Bel-Marduk, that was part of the ceremony of the installation as king in Assyria and also in Babylon, according to Babylonian Assyrian Religion Encyclopedia Britannica. The celebration of the winter solstice around December 25th was regarded as the birthday of the sun. It was a major holiday associated with gift given in the sacred evergreen tree. When a conquering nation takes over, many times in the cases of these three kingdoms that followed Babylon, they adopted the gods of the people that they conquered and made them part of their own. The sun gods, Bel-Marduk, the Akkadian Shamash, and the Amalekite Nahante appear to have greatly influenced the Western Iranian religious beliefs in Persia, when Persia conquered. Such was their importance that in the ancient Near East, that it maybe had become necessary to find a counterpart with the Iranian pantheon that they already had. Now, the Iranian sun god, which was Harv Gasheti, or Khorshid is another name, was not clearly prominent enough for such a position. So the Magi of the Persian Empire there, they appeared to match these sun gods with one of the Iranian Ahuras, Mithra, who is primarily a god of contract, friendship, and love, with only a minor association with the sun. Now Mithra's new role was absorbed into Zoroastrianism by the Persians. Therefore, he remained principally a sun god. In his name, however, in modern Persia, Mir, also it means love. Now, the Persians also adopted Ishtar, combining her with identifying her with their Western Iranian goddess, Anahiti, also known by her Greek rendering of the name Anitis. As you can already see, the Greeks began to adopt these gods as well. Once they conquered the Medes and the Persians, they started to borrow their gods as well and adopted them to theirs. The Magi appear to have matched Anahiti with the great Near Eastern planetarian goddess, which represented Venus. This tradition was also maintained after the arrival of Zoroastrianism. To date, the word Anahit or Nahid in modern Persian means the planet Venus. Even Nabu, remember Nabu? He was identified with Tiri, the great Yazati of the star, Cyrus, the dog star. The Magi appear to have matched Tiri with Nabu, which represented the planet Mercury in the Near East. The Persians, along with the Medes, adopted many of these various gods of the Middle Eastern religions. The Greeks of Asia Minor identified the Persian sun god Mithras with their ancient sun god Helios, along with the more modern sun god Apollo, and contributed to the Western spread of the cult of the sun. Alexander the Great, he traveled to Egypt to the temple of Amon Ra to be proclaimed by the priest as the literal son of the sun god. Again, he thought he was Apollo. Apollo was referred to as the god of light and the god of truth. Did you hear that? Apollo. It was referred to as the god of light and the god of truth, and served as an intermediary between gods and men. The Romans just copied the Greek gods, changing their names. Except for Apollo. That was the exception. They didn't change Apollo's name. Everybody else. They changed Zeus to Jupiter. But they didn't change Apollo's name. They also adopted the worship of other gods, including the Egyptian gods and Persia's sun god Mithras, who now they identified as Sol Invictus. Sol Invictus means unconquered sun, which was the official sun god of the latter Roman Empire and the patron of soldiers. On December 25th, 274 AD, the Roman Emperor Aurelian made it an official cult alongside the traditional Roman cults. The Romans combined their old sun god with their new one and held a festival on December 25th in honor of the sun god. Part of their celebration would be racing chariots at the Circus Maximus. That's according to the Cult of Sol Invictus by G.H. Helzberg. Saturnalia was a festival that was celebrated in the Roman Empire for 7 days leading up to December 25th, dedicated to the god Saturn. The Romans believe Sol, their god Sol, died on December 21st before being reborn 3 days later on December 25th. Sound familiar? December 21st and the 3 days that follow are the shortest and therefore the darkest days of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, as we know. Sol Invictus played a prominent role in the Mithraic mysteries and was portrayed as being equated with, equal with, or an epithet of Mithras. Although the relationship between the public cults themselves is controversial. The New Testament scholar Helmut Koester, in his book Introduction to the New Testament, says, although Mithras appears to be the most oriental god among the new deities, and although his cult is essentially celebrated in exclusive mystery associations, the Mithras cult was a mystery religion, in the strict sense of the word. This god was received by the Romans without resistance, and at the end of the 3rd century AD, as Sol Invictus, he became the official god of the Roman state. Along with Mithras or Sol, the sun god of Rome, he had a wife who was associated with the planet Venus. Again, how many goddesses have we seen that identify with Venus? According to the SabbathCovenant.com, Cybele, the Phrygian goddess, was known to her father as the mother of God. She was closely related to the worship of Mithra. Just as Mithraism is a man's religion, the worship of Cybele was practiced by women. The priests of Mithra were known as fathers, and the priestesses of Cybele as mothers. After baptism into the mysteries of Mithra, the initiate was marked on the forehead. The sign of a cross formed by an elliptical and the celestial equator is one of the signs of Mithra. Sunday, the day of the sun, was considered the sacred day of rest. December 25th, the birthday of Mithra, was celebrated as the birth of the sun, given birth by the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God. She was also known in Rome as Magna Mater, the Great Mother. The Romans set up a temple for her on Vatican Hill, which was not one of the seven hills of Rome. The Mons Vaticanus, as it was known, it laid outside the ancient city limits, facing Rome from across the river Tiber. The hill's name was Etruscan in origin, for their god of prophecies, Vaticanus, whose temple was also on this hill. For the Romans, however, the hill was the perfect place for other activities that are not appropriate in the city. It was the site of the Temple of Cybele and her son Attis, the gods of the Greek mystery cult that was brought to Rome in the late Republic. It became a place of martyrdom as the Roman Emperor Caligula built a circus and an amphitheater there for games. To crown the center of the amphitheater, Caligula had his forces transport from Egypt a pylon that originally stood in Heliopolis. The obelisk was made of a single piece of red granite weighing more than 350 tons and was erected for an Egyptian pharaoh more than 3,000 years ago. In 1586, it was moved to its present location in St. Peter's Square, where it does double duty as a giant sundial. In 65 AD, at this location, Emperor Nero carried out the notorious executions of suspected Christians he blamed for burning of Rome. Of course, some teach that Peter went to Rome and was killed and his bones were buried under the basilica, but there's no biblical mention that Peter ever went to Rome, as he had his own areas that he was responsible for, like Babylon. This person may very well be Simon Magnus, who is mentioned in Acts chapter 8, but that's another story. Christianity spread throughout the Roman Empire as the apostles and the disciples of Jesus Christ taught his ways. Paul goes to Rome, and he teaches until he was finally executed. The apostle John warns that Christianity was being contaminated by outside influences and philosophies in his letters. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18, little children, it is the last hour. And as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come, by which we know that this is the last hour. They went out from among us, or from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out that they might be made manifest that none of them were of us. Verse 22. Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? These false teachers were saying that Jesus was not the Christ. Who is a liar but who denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. Verse 26, these things I have written to you concerning those who tried to deceive you. In 2 John chapter 7, it says, for many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is the deceiver and an antichrist. In verse 9 it says, whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house nor greet him. For he who greets him shares in his evil deeds. Jude also has harsh words for those who were deceiving the brethren and abusing their powers in the church. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of the truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. Peter continues to warn us about these deceivers and wrongdoers throughout the rest of this chapter. This shows that even before the original apostles died, that false teachers had already crept in, teaching false doctrines, denying Jesus was the Christ, teaching a false Jesus. They were already teaching a false Jesus, probably mixed with paganism. This continued on until Emperor Constantine the Great made the practice of Christianity legal in Rome. However, he continued to have his coins inscribed with the words Sol Invicto Committi, which means committed to the invincible Son. He also is the one who decided to have the church build the original basilica on Vatican Hill, on top of the ancient burial ground containing many of the martyred Christian bones. He also influenced the church to worship on Sunday, and even changed the calendar from 10 days in a week to 7 days in a week, with Sunday as the first day of the week, so that people can keep it. He also set up the Christian holidays with fixed dates, with a flexible date for Easter on the calendar. Historians credit him with removing some of the more offensive pagan celebrations, but many of the other pagan rituals were adopted as part of the Christian faith. He initiated the evolution of the empire into the Christian state, with the Roman Catholic Church as the premier universal church, as Catholic does mean universal. The Roman Catholic Church continued to grow in strength, as did the popes. Leo, one of the only two popes according to the appellation, the Great, he played a pivotal role in the early history of the papacy. Assuming the title of Pontifex Maximus, or chief priest, he made an important distinction between the person of the Pope and his office, maintaining that the office assumed the full power bestowed on Peter, as they believe Peter was the first Pope. The link between Peter and the office of Bishop of Rome was stressed by Pope Gelasius, of 422 to 496 AD, who was the first pope who actually was to be referred to as the Vicar of Christ. In his theory of the two swords, Gelasius articulated a dualistic power structure, insisting that the pope embodied the spiritual power while the emperor embodied the temporal power. This is what history records on the Christian beliefs that were combined with ancient rituals that were originated in Babylon. One must compare that to what the scriptures reveal. You can look at history and you can look at what the scriptures reveal. God's word is accurate. God's word is accurate. The prophecies fulfilled continue to show that this is true. In Revelation chapter 17, in verse 5, and on her head was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. I read several commentaries for verse 6, and to my surprise, many do not address this very well. Some ignore it completely, while others blame a pagan church or an unknown counterfeit church. Others, like John Gill, mention the church in Rome. One only needs to look at history of the churches to determine for themselves if the scriptures hold true. Again, in Revelation chapter 13, he gives more details about this end-time church leader, as well as throughout the history of the church. In verse 11, this leader had two horns like a lamb, but spoke like a dragon. From the booklet, The Beast of Revelation by John H. Owen asked the question, historically, was there an institution claiming to represent Christ, like the Lamb, verse 11, and holding sway over the populace by means of various miracles, verse 14. An institution which taught the devil's false message that God's law was done away and which insists that its inheritors give their loyalty to the Holy Roman Empire. Throughout the medieval period, the Church of Rome did exactly this. So why the two horns of this beast, the two horns of this lamb that speaks with a dragon? The Church of Rome is both an ecclesiastical and a civil government. The Pope is both the religious leader and the civil head of state. Bible prophecy shows that the church-state union of the Middle Ages was a forerunner of the end-time events whose scale will be far grander. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 20 gives us another name for this church leader. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet, who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. This end-time false prophet is also referred to in Revelation chapter 16, Revelation chapter 16, verse 13. This prophecy is dealing with the very end time when Christ is about to return. Now Paul writes it will involve the revealing of the man of sin, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, that is worship, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. That's in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Some man is going to put himself in place of God, effectively claiming to be God, and the people will believe him. This man of sin has taken to himself titles and authorities that belong only to God. He will sit as a veritable God in the temple of God, using some of the very titles of God. The seventh revival of the Roman Empire is yet to occur. We know from scriptures that it will be made up of 10 kingdoms or nations with one man in charge of all. This man will be the Antichrist, the false leader, the beast, with all the support of Satan. There will also be this man of sin, this false prophet, the little horn, the beast with two horns like a lamb who speaks like a dragon. Can we absolutely know the identity of this man and which religious organization that they hail from? Again, from that article by Mr. Walford answering the question, do we know for certain that the woman or the church from where this false prophet hails is Roman? His words say, on the basis of the evidence, the identification of the woman of Revelation chapter 17 as being specifically the Roman Catholic Church needs to be qualified. That it includes Romanism could be deduced from the association of the woman with the beast of Revelation 13, which previously has been shown to be the revival of the Roman Empire. Her intimate association with the Roman rulers in the end time is further supported by Revelation chapter 17, verses 9 through 12. Even if, for the sake of argument, the seven mountains are not specific reference to the city of Rome, a conclusion which many have challenged. It is nevertheless true that the seven kings mentioned in Revelation chapter 17, verse 10 are obviously Roman, and that the ten horns represent ten kings in Revelation chapter 17, verse 12, are kings who are part of a ten-nation confederacy, which is also Roman. Hence, the woman religiously is affiliated with the revived Roman Empire. to identify the woman as specifically the Roman Catholic Church, however, is to go beyond the Scriptures. Actually, according to Revelation chapter 17, verse 15, the woman is pictured in the place of authority over people and multitudes and nations and tongues. Her sphere of rule is obviously worldwide and goes beyond the bounds of the Roman Empire politically, at least in its early stage. And he continues, in view of the fact that there does not seem to be any religious opposition to the woman, and her sway seems to be complete except for individual saints whom she persecutes, the evidence seems to support the fact that the woman represents an ecumenical or worldwide church embracing all Christianity religiously, and therefore including not only the Roman Catholic Church, but Protestant and Greek Orthodoxy as well. This is a statement that Dr. Wolford wrote. In March 2013, Pope Francis, who was elected as the first non-European pope in 1,300 years, met leaders of the non-Catholic Christian religion, such as the Orthodox, Anglicans, Lutherans, Methodists, and others, including Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus. Recently, he has even met with Seventh-day Adventists and with atheists. This is the first pope to reach out to the Orthodox Church, which held its influence in the Eastern Roman Empire since that split years ago. Since then, Pope Francis and Orthodox Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople have been working together to unite all Christians. This was never done in history before, the Pope reaching out to, you know, this other leader of the Orthodox Church. And they're working together to try to unite all of Christianity. It looks as though the article that was written by Dr. John Wolford is coming to that same conclusion. He said that this is something that would have to happen. Dr. Wolford, he wrote this article in October 1969. He died about maybe 18, 19 years ago. If he saw what was going on now, scratch the head. Throughout history, we can see that this church in Rome modeled itself after the mystery religion of Babylon. The daughter churches which sprung from it has adopted many, if not all, the practices and rituals which were borrowed from Babylon. The gods have different names, just like other religions that sprung from the Babylonian religion. However, these new names, these new God names are God and Jesus. How can this be so? A false Christianity has taken the name of God and transformed it into something else. They teach a false Jesus, who is the Son of God, or the Sun God, like Mithras, Apollo, or Bel Marduk. They even misrepresented Mary, the mother of Jesus, as their Queen of Heaven, like Ishtar, Isis, Cybele. They have adopted the principle of a Trinity, like many of the other pagan religions have. And we talked about that before. There's many other Trinities out there. Mystery Babylon the Great is called a mother of many harlot daughters who came out of her in protest because they disagreed with a few of her abominations. Too bad it was only a few of her abominations, since the Protestant churches kept many of them. The church in Rome took the authority to change God's Holy Sabbath day to Sunday. Why didn't her daughters change it back when they came out of her? One example. With all that we have seen and heard over these series of sermons about Mystery Babylon, we need to be watchful for this church that sits upon the beast. In the not too distant future, a last revival of the Holy Roman Empire will emerge and will look to a universal church at that time to support and crown that new world leader, that beast, the Antichrist. The United Kingdom has left the EU, and the rest of Europe will have to revise some kind of a government structure. What 10 nations will form this new United Europe? Will the overall leader rise in Rome? And will the church in Rome crown him, or will it be a new united universal church with all the different Christianity religions combined together? We can't say for certain that it is one church or another, but it is a religious leader that's in charge of a universal church. We must remain diligent and keep watch over world affairs.